Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission? This episode is part of a larger series called Momentum, presented by Monogram Appliances, which aims to celebrate Asian leaders. Elevate your culinary domain with Monogram Luxury Appliances, where sophistication meets performance. Each piece is crafted for those who demand excellence. From precision-engineered ovens and cooktops with sapphire glass, to stunning refrigerator interiors that use aerospace technology, you can experience the art of cooking like never before. Monogram is redefining luxury in the kitchen. Visit monogram.ca and transform your kitchen into a statement of elegance and innovation. Connie, I'm so excited to have you here today. I've been following your brand for years and I'm just... is this our first time meeting?
I think it is.
It's so wild because I feel like we've like exchanged emails and I've seen you on social media, and it's so great to be able to be talking IRL today.
I know, it's crazy. I was like, is this our first time meeting? I think it is.
I know.
Such an honor, and I'm really excited to chat with you.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about obviously just this wild and wonderful world of beauty and everything that comes with that. But why don't we start off with, when you were growing up, were you like a beauty buff or like a beauty stan? Like, what was your first experience with beauty like? And was that something that was within your universe?
Yeah. So, I mean, my first wellness memory that I have, and then we can get into beauty, is my grandma. She made this soup, and I remember she turned to me and gave it to me, and I was really skinny as a kid, and she was like, Connie, if you drink this, it'll help you gain weight. And then 2 seconds later, she turns to my sister and she's like, and if you drink this, it'll help you lose weight. And I was like, okay, so beauty is super confusing and very subjective. And that was my earliest memory, like dabbling in beauty and wellness. But then later on, when I was in grade 5, so I was about 10 years old, that's when I really got into beauty. So at that time, I started to develop preteen acne. I don't know if you've ever gone through that, but it really impacted my confidence. And I remember I'd spend hours at my local Shoppers Drug Mart trying to find something that was targeted for breakouts. And I would literally spend hours looking at the ingredients, trying everything. And in retrospect, I think I used too many products at once and I disrupted my skin barrier because my skin just became so red and inflamed. And so out of desperation, I turned to my mom. My mom's really into holistic wellness and natural skincare. And she was like, well, Connie, if you've already tried everything that's synthetic, like, what do you have to lose by trying something that's plant-based? And I was like, I guess that's true. So we went to our local farmer's market and Whole Foods that weekend. And she started to introduce me to different ingredients that were good for my skin type. So I remember I'd make face masks after school with things like oats for sensitive skin and green tea and banana for whitening and like egg white for like lifting, even though I was like 10 years old. I definitely didn't need the egg white. So I would start to make my own skincare masks after school. So I became known as that girl in grade 5 that would make her own skincare. And lo and behold, after a couple of weeks of making my own skincare mask, as well as starting to eat better, my skin drastically cleared up. Like, it was noticeable. And it was at that point that I became obsessed with beauty. And so, like you said, I was a beauty junkie. But I never thought I would make that into a career. So I went to school for business, went to Queen's University, graduated, started working in marketing and sales. And then it was during this time that I was introduced to Laura, who's my co-founder.
Nice. I love how you summarized that whole story there. when we, think about that time when you were like perusing the eyes of Shoppers and trying to figure out like what to get for your acne and everything, like what was the dominant, I guess, narrative around beauty? And like at that time, like what did it mean to be beautiful, if you remember at that time?
I mean, clear skin was such a big part of it. And I mean,
I
was
proactive commercials. I remember that so
much. Proactive, St. Ives apricot scrub. I've really tried them all. But I remember back then the beauty standards were a lot of what you would see in magazines. I feel like people growing up now have it so much harder. Like I always say, I'm so grateful I didn't grow up in the age of social media. Because Instagram, I think, started to become popular when I was going into university. And you're so impressed fashionable when you're younger. And I know for a fact that my confidence would have been way worse if Instagram was around when I was going through these skincare issues. And interestingly enough, I remember looking at an old journal entry that I have, because I've been keeping a diary since I was like 5 years old or something like that. And I found an entry from that time where I literally drew myself, it's so sad, but I drew myself with a line down the piece of paper. On the left is what I thought I looked like, and on the right was what I wanted to look like. And one of the things I noticed was that I drew a bunch of dots over my skin because I had acne, and I was like, but the beautiful version of me would not have this acne, would be skinnier, would have more shiny hair, flat stomach, all these things that you read about in magazines. So actually, I really strongly remember that time because of how much it impacted me.
Wow. So when you looked back on that journal entry, how did that make you feel as an adult and also now as like a founder of a beauty brand and a wellness brand?
I think like I just would want to give the 10 to 15 year old Connie a big hug and be like, you're going to be okay. And also these standards are so unrealistic. Another thing during that time is Photoshop. Like at least now brands are starting to become more open about not airbrushing the photos in their ads or videos in their campaigns. But back then, I think almost every brand was using Photoshop. So the people that you're seeing in these magazines, they don't even look like that themselves, but you don't realize that when you're young. And another thing I want to say about beauty standards during that time and how I felt was I felt like I was straddling two worlds of being Canadian but also being Taiwanese/Chinese, because in North America, the beauty standard is to be tanned and, mm-hmm. you know, like that gives you a lean look. But then in Asia, the beauty standard is to be lighter and like, you know, there's all these lightening products that you would use. I remember there was this papaya soap that was really popular in Asia during that time that I actually bought and like had imported from Thailand or something, and I paid all the duties. I didn't even know what duties were back then, so my parents were probably really annoyed, but I bought it and I was using this on my skin because I was like, I want to be lighter. And my grandma was saying like, you need to walk with an umbrella when you're out, but then all my friends at school were darker. And then when I would go back to Asia, I would feel like a foreigner, even though that was technically my like homeland. So it was just a very confusing time for my identity, and I think beauty played a big role in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, that is so reflective of like the experience of immigrant children or like the diaspora outside of the motherland, is like straddling what those two identities are.
You don't feel like you belong in either.
Yeah, exactly. So when you were growing up, you know, when do you think you came out of that phase where you were able to accept yourself as beautiful and like and redefine like what that meant for yourself?
I feel like it's really a journey. I mean, I recently turned 31, and I only think it was around 30 that I really fully started to accept myself, which is a lot longer than you would think, right? And I think along the way, you know, living away from home when I was studying at Queen's and going on exchange in Europe and seeing different people and exploring different cultures, that really helped, because I didn't feel like I had my parents' voice in the back of my head all the time. No matter how loving they are and how much it's just coming from a good place, a lot of the times it can come across as criticism. You know, like you're dressed too white, or you're dressed too much like a Canadian, or again, your skin's too dark, or like there's a whole laundry list of things. And being away from my parents helped a lot when it came to forming my own identity. And I feel like when you develop your own identity and you start to become more comfortable in your skin, that's when you feel beautiful, because you know yourself more. And I think in your 20s, you're figuring that out. I always admired my friends who like knew from the first day of first year university what they wanted to be and like had their 10-year plan. I did not have that. And even though we started Three Ships when we were 23, I think those early years, I was still navigating who I was. But I would say 30 is when I really figured it out. So
honestly,
it's been a year.
Yeah. Honestly, I think that it, like, to have a full sense of yourself and your identity in your 20s is like, a lot of people have not even, like people's brains haven't even fully developed and stuff. So I think that is actually definitely more often the case for people of understanding themselves in their 30s and having enough life experience to inform like who they are and their value set and everything. The other thing too is I resonate with your your notes on like envying people that understood like the 10-year plan. Because I also went to school for business, but before that, I went to school for science. And I remember everyone was like, I know exactly what track I want to be on. This is like my 15-year plan of like being like a this whatever surgeon or doctor. I'm like, wow, I envy the fact that people have this like very clear, crystal clear idea of like exactly where they want to go and where they need to be by this amount of, like this time and that time. And for me, I was like,
You had the courage to break out of it. And I feel like some people, maybe they at first thought that was their long-term plan, but maybe along the way they realized they weren't passionate about science, but they didn't have the conviction to do what you did. It's all about like perspective of where you are in your life and how much courage you have. So yeah, that's difficult though. Breaking from science to business is a big shift.
Yeah, tell me about it. So you have a background in marketing. What inspired you to start Three Ships, and what were you doing before? And were you able to bring any of those skills into building your business?
I feel like every job and experience you have actually lends itself to where you are. So my first like part-time job, or one of my first, was at Club Monaco. I was a stylist in my first year summer. A very generous term. It's like a sales associate. But like that's where I really learned how to sell, and I learned how to listen to what people were saying and create outfits around what they were telling me, and what they really wanted, not just what they were saying. And I feel like sales and listening, that's such a big part of my job now at Three Ships. And then after that, when I graduated from Queens, I went to KPMG for only 8 months. I actually quit before I even wrote my exams. And a lot of people were like, you're crazy. Just like stay until you can write the CFE, and at least you can get the CPA letters behind your name. But for me, I'm like, I know I'm never going to want to go into accounting and finance after this. So why waste the time? And I'm so glad I did that. I moved into marketing and sales at Kimberly Clark. So they make like Huggies, Kleenex, other brands. And it was during this time I learned a lot about like branding, working with agencies, like marketing budgets, obviously account management as well. And it was during that time I met Laura. So the idea for Three Ships came because Laura was thinking of making a natural makeup remover. And she was just talking to some of her friends about the idea. And one of our friends who went to fifth grade with me and remembered that I was that crazy girl who would make her own skincare, he was like, you should talk to Connie because she is really into natural beauty and she'd probably have some ideas for you. So what was meant to be this like quick 30-minute dinner became this 3.5-ish hour co-founder first date is what we call it.
Right.
We were actually kicked out of the restaurant they were staying at because they were like, you guys are spending way too long here. And then we went to the Starbucks across the street. And it was in that co-founder first date that we realized like we would be amazing co-founders. We're complete opposites in terms of skill sets and personality types. We actually even told each other our Myers-Briggs. So I am an ESFJ Myers-Briggs and she is INTP. I love the front end of the business. She loves the back end. She's a chemical engineer, very process driven, but we have completely aligned values. And I think that's so important for building trust in a co-founder pair. You know, and you also want to make sure that you have opposite skill sets so you're not doing the same part of the business. So that was how we initially got started into talking about creating Three Ships. But the reason why I want to create a company is because we were just two 23-year-olds who could not afford high-quality natural skincare. Brands usually overprice their products like crazy. Like, the markups are absolutely insane in the beauty industry, especially in the natural beauty industry, because people are paying for ingredients. So you have brands that are charging like $300+ for a product or a routine, or you have brands that are on the other end of the spectrum that are greenwashing and are using terms like natural, but they're not natural at all because there's no legal definition for natural, which is absolutely crazy.
Yeah,
as well.
It's very like nebulous.
Yeah, whatever. And so people either are overpaying for something that might work for them that is plant-based, or they're settling for something that's cheap and ineffective and not actually natural. So that was where this idea came. We're like, we know that we can make a truly natural brand, and to us that means being plant and mineral derived, so no chemicals, but at an accessible price point and combining science into there, so making sure it's effective. So you're not just using something that's plant-based and like affordable, but it's not actually doing anything.
Right.
So we pooled together our savings, and we each had $2,000 in our bank accounts, and we literally got started the next day while working our 9-to-5s, so we side hustled it for a year and a half.
Amazing. I mean, that's my next question. I mean, you started on a shoestring of $4,000 back in 2017. Where did you focus that initial, you know, investment, and how did you even know that that was the right place to focus it? I mean, like, there's so many places that you could, that a company requires, you know, support on. So how did you know where to put that?
I mean, we made a lot of mistakes. Like, I remember one of our first meetings, we spent 3 hours designing our business cards, which we didn't even end up using because no one uses business cards anymore. So I would say, like, we've learned a lot along the way. Some of the investments that we made with that $4,000 were around production. We also got our website, so really important to secure your domain. We got a $300 laser printer that we would use to print our own labels in my apartment because we couldn't pay for custom labels because the minimum order quantities were so high. So a lot of that $4,000 was earmarked towards like production, like getting bowls to mix our skincare in my apartment, getting like the oils and the ingredients. And then our hypothesis around new skincare brands, which I think was correct, is that when you're a new brand with very limited marketing budget, it's good to be places where customers can smell, touch, and feel the product. Because there's so many brands out there now that are D2C and online, and you're getting hit with a bunch of ads every day. But you want to be able to try it, and ideally at a retailer that's reputable, that you already trust. And that builds a trust, and then they either buy in store or they buy from you online later. So that's why I love my focus when we first started was pitching retailers. So to answer your question, Laura really thought a lot about the product side, setting up the website. I really thought about where is the customer. So I would be walking up and down the streets of Toronto in neighborhoods that I thought our ideal retail partner would be. So the small independent retailers on Queen Street West or Distillery District, I literally would just walk up and down those streets. And speaking of mistakes, I also learned like buyers are not in store all the time. Like I remember I went to Urban Outfitters and I was like, can I talk to your buyer? And they were like, oh honey, that's in the head office in like LA. I was like, okay, well, can you connect me with your store manager to connect me to the buyer? And they're like, that's not how it works. So later I realized, okay, so you go to trade shows to meet those buyers. So, and then that informed where we'd use the rest of our money. So like that's, you kind of learn along the way and you say yes to opportunities. And the last thing I'll say is we also met our customers where they're at little like farmers markets and craft fairs. So on the weekends when Laura and I weren't working our 9-to-5s, we would go to different farmers markets across the greater Toronto area and we would actually sell to customers and use their feedback to iterate on our product and our packaging.
Wow. So you were busy on top of a regular day job.
Yeah. During so we'd that meet time. Up Monday and Wednesday nights after work, she would come over, Laura would come over to my place Monday nights, and that would be like manufacturing because everything was in my apartment. And then Wednesday nights would be at Laura's place because we would work on more like strategy things, like making the website and things that don't require production. And then Saturday or Sunday, we'd work a full day at least. And then the other day, if there was a farmer's market, we would go. If not, it would be our rest day.
I'm curious, like you talk about growing up and your mom would make these like home remedies and things and then fast forward and it's like almost like a full circle moment where you're doing it literally in your kitchen or in your home with your co-founder. What was that conversation like when you had it with your family about doing that? Like, were they super receptive to it?
Yeah, it's a good question because I think people would assume that with Asian parents, they would not be supportive. But I think they honestly were the most supportive, and I was shocked. but I think it's because they could see the determination that I had. And I'd also run businesses in the past in high school and also at Queens. I was involved in entrepreneurial activities. So, and my dad's an entrepreneur. So I think like they knew that I was exposed to it enough. And when I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And I think I really keep my word with the things I say. I think confidence is really about keeping the promises you make to yourself. So they know that about me. So I think that's why they were so supportive. You know, in those beginning days, like we would make things in my kitchen and eventually we outsourced production, not into a manufacturer, but into my parents' basement. So after we like moved and graduated from my little 500 square foot apartment and we just completely outgrew that, we moved all production, i.e. like our buckets and our ingredients, to my parents' basement. And they actually let us stay there for like a year and a half until we outgrew there. So like speaking of support, I mean like my dad would be our like operations guy, like obviously for free. So he would help to print the labels. He would drop off the packages at Canada Post. My mom would cook for us when Laura and I would go uptown to make the products with them. And then of course they were helping us make all these products by hand. So reflecting back on how my upbringing influenced Three Ships, it kind of was like very surreal to see this full circle moment because it would make me think of those days of making product or making skincare with my parents. And I remember I would like lie down on the couch after school and I would have cucumbers over my eyes and like this oat mask on my face. And then from going from that to making things in stainless steel mixing bowls to eventually graduating to a 20 liter Home Depot bucket to eventually outsourcing manufacturing, it's kind of surreal, not gonna lie.
Yeah, no kidding. And it's like a family business.
It is. And my parents are so supportive and so involved. Like my dad still messages me and Laura almost every day with ideas and inspo. And I really don't think we would not be here without my parents because they were that supportive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanna go back to your note around sustainability and like natural ingredients and like clean beauty, I guess, overall, when you first started to create the brand with Laura, what was like the general discussion around like quote unquote clean beauty at that time? Because it's changed throughout the years.
It's changed a lot.
And also, as you noted too, there's no defined definition of like what it means to be a clean beauty or sustainable beauty brand, and there's no actual governing body that kind of regulates that. So what was that conversation happening at that time, and how, and then, you know, you talked about how you wanted to change it, but my other question or second part to that is, what, when you think about like natural ingredients and then accessible price points, was that a myth that you could get both at the same time at that time, without sacrificing quality, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So within the natural beauty space, there were only a few key players back then. And we started in 2017, and there was like Tata Harper was a really, really popular one. But as you know, her products are quite pricey. Mm-hmm. But her whole thing was farm to table. So I think the story around natural back then when we started was a lot around like farm to table or like earth to, you know, skin vibes. A lot of the things out there were also quite granola, so to speak. So very like, oh, I made this in my kitchen and like that's the whole brand. Versus Laura and I knew that we would eventually grow out of my kitchen. Well, we hoped. And so like that was the idea around natural. Back then, a lot of people thought natural had to be expensive because the process by which you extract the ingredients from the earth would be more expensive, which we later debunked. And people thought natural didn't work as well as things that were synthetic. So, and oh, another thing around that clean beauty, a lot of people thought clean beauty just meant like no parabens, no sulfates, maybe no SLS. So it was a lot about like the no list. Like there's a brand that's quite famous that has like a dirty dozen list or something like that. And people are like, wow, they avoid 12 ingredients versus like we avoid close to 2,000. So that was like the standard back then, which meant there was a lot of opportunity for Laura and me. So for us, we made sure that when we launched, we had a full list of every ingredient we avoided and every ingredient that's in our products. A lot of brands would just have like, we avoid XYZ and this is our active ingredient. For us, we're like, no, people deserve to know everything they're putting on their skin. That's how you build trust as a natural brand. Around the affordability in your question, like your part two question around can natural be affordable? I think it can be. And the reason why I say this is the markups in beauty, if people knew how much they were paying for branding and how much of the P&L of these large CPGs is just going straight to marketing, I think they'd be really shocked and also a little upset. And I get it. Everyone falls for brands. I do as well. And branding, and I love a good brand. But when Laura and I start to dig into costs of what's actually going to the inky list or the ingredient list of these products, we were stunned by how cheap they were. And nowadays, there's so many more sophisticated ways of extracting natural ingredients from the earth that it's actually a lot cheaper. So, for example, a lot of people think that us using upcycled ingredients, which means taking waste from other industries and repurposing them in our products, is really expensive. But a lot of the times, it's the same price or same cost as using something that's fresh. So, for example, in one of our serums, 800,000 blueberries that are upcycled from the juicing industry go into 1 kilogram of the active of our vitamin A alternative. And they're like, wow, that must be really expensive to take these blueberries that have already been used, but it's the same cost as using fresh blueberries. So,
interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's very nebulous, the natural industry. And that's why we really want to create a definition for natural. And we're going to fight to actually have a governing body and have regulators, you know, review brands and what they're saying and putting on their packaging. Otherwise, consumers rely on different retailers to tell them their, you know, Sephora Clean and Planet Positive stamp versus Whole Foods guidelines versus the detox market. It's too confusing for people.
It is overwhelming for people to navigate the the shopping aisle. And even if you are an educated consumer and you are like a curious consumer and you're looking at the labels, it's still very confusing because people are using different ways of measuring and defining this and that, and there's different regulations or different certifications, I guess, that mean different things. And so as a consumer, it's like, what do you go?
And it's also like, for example, people can be really sneaky in their marketing. They can say things like, we don't test on animals, and you're like, okay, that's great. But that could mean that they outsource the animal testing to a third party. So that's why there's different governing bodies like Leaping Bunny and CertifiedVegan.org certified and all of that. And on top of that, there's a lot of fear mongering in the beauty industry where a lot of natural brands will be like, if you use chemical, then you will get cancer or do all, you know, there's a lot. And the way that we try to lead at Three Ships is we really try not to dabble in that at all. I'm a big believer that chemical does have its place. Mm-hmm. If you want to use something that's not natural, go for it. What we stand for is if you do want to use something that's natural, you shouldn't have to question if it's natural. So that's where we differentiate ourselves.
And I think the other conversation that's really interesting within that world too is that it's very binary in that like this is good and this is bad, but not all chemicals are harmful and not all natural things are good for you either. There are, you know, there's probably bad natural ones and there's also good synthetic chemicals too. And that I think is a conversation that is...
There's some natural ingredients that are not safe for pregnancy or breastfeeding. There's some essential oils that if you use them on your skin, I feel like that's the most common example. A lot of essential oils are not good for your skin. And so some people have bad experiences with natural beauty where they'll try one product where unfortunately the brand didn't do their research around the essential oil. They have a big breakout or some sort of irritation. They're like, okay, never again. I'm just going to use clinically tested derm products. So yeah, I think that that's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as you're building this company and when you're looking back on your own kind of experiences navigating the beauty and the wellness industries, and also the kind of dialogue that's happening, how would you say your, you know, identity as an Asian woman has influenced your approach to building a modern beauty brand like Three Ships?
Well, I think the way I was brought up, beauty was a lot more than just surface level. Like, actually, my mom, we were just talking about this over the weekend. She's like, you know, I never, like, commented on your looks when you were a kid. I'm like, I know. I was very, like, not confident because of that. And she was like, but it's because I always want to bring you up with thinking about beauty from being, like, kind and the way you treat other people and the way you think about yourself, like, that's beautiful. You can tell someone has confidence and that's beauty. It's not just what you're putting on your skin. Another thing around Asian beauty is a lot of Asian beauty circles around skincare versus, I think, more Western beauty. Well, maybe not now, but at least when I was growing up, a lot of Western beauty was makeup. So for us growing up, it was if you take care of yourselves, take care of yourself from the inside, you eat better, you use, you know, better skincare products, then you won't need to cover yourself up with makeup. And I think that has influenced a lot of the way I think about Three Ships. Like, we're all about, you know, less is more. Obviously, we don't make makeup. And I think we also do a lot around like beautiful before, beautiful after, instead of like a before and after photo. We always say beautiful before, beautiful after. Obviously, no retouching, and focusing on like quality ingredients. Again, less is more. So I think that's been a big influence for me. And obviously, a lot of the ingredients I grew up with actually influence our product development. So for example, in our Dewdrop Serum, which is one of our best sellers, has the tremella mushroom. And I remember talking to my mom about this in my parents' kitchen one day when we were first formulating the Dewdrop Serum. And I was like, oh my God, it's such a revolutionary ingredient. It's a mushroom and it just like helps your skin retain moisture. Have you heard of this? And my mom, like without saying a word, she turns onto her cupboard and she like opens the cupboard and she pulls out a bag of this dried mushroom. And it's called muir in Chinese. And she's like, Connie, I've been feeding this to you since you were a kid. It's in your like soups and stews. I don't know if you've had it before.
I feel like every Asian household has some sort of dried mushroom in a cupboard.
Yeah, like ginseng and all these other dried things.
My parents definitely have it, and I feel like they've also foraged for it, and I'm like,
oh my God,
you need to be really careful about them.
My mom's never gone that far, but she probably has friends who forage for her and give it to her. And so she was like, yeah, this is something that you grew up with because it's known to help you hydrate and like it protects your skin. And I was like, dang. So that's actually the hero ingredient in our Dewdrop Serum. So I think as I've gotten older, I realized like a lot of the ways that I was brought up do kind of sneakily impact the way Three Ships operates. Mm-hmm. And Laura, my co-founder, is a quarter Chinese, so I'm sure that she has some of that as well. But yeah, it's very interesting how things are full circle.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that as a brand, you guys don't produce makeup, but one of the kind of conversations that I find are happening within the beauty industry is really around, like, obviously inclusivity as like a larger umbrella, but within that, if you kind of like drill it in, there is a conversation around shadism and colorism. Mm-hmm. And that's a very prevalent issue within our communities. Yeah. As well. How do you think that, you know, those conversations have shaped your experiences or your perspective on beauty and being an inclusive brand?
It's a really tricky topic, and I think it's one of the reasons why Laura and I aren't in color cosmetics right now. Because, mm-hmm. like, if you think about it from both sides, on one side, naturally, people now, or brands now, have the technology to make products for, like, pretty much every skin tone. And as a consumer, whether you're Black or Asian or white, you should be able to find something that works for you. Like, that is something I truly believe in. And there are brands that can do that. Like, for yeah. example, Lady Gaga's house brand. I know mm-hmm. that's a really famous one for meeting everyone's shade tones. There's an Asian brand called Orsay. Have you heard of them?
Orsay.
Okay. I think it's like O-R-C-E with a little apostrophe. But she also is an Asian founder, and she makes foundations for Asian skin tones because she found that a lot of the normal brands, they would have like more orange kind of tones in there, and she's like, we need more yellow. So that's one side. Obviously, people should be able to find a product for them. But what a lot of consumers don't see as well, and I understand it from a small business perspective, is the minimum order quantities that are involved with the shade ranges. So yeah. if you're a new brand and you want to create foundation, you need to be able to meet all those shade ranges, but the minimum order quantities for each shade could be like maybe 5,000 units. I'm not sure about color, but within skincare, at least 5,000 to 10,000 units per SKU. So if you only have a limited amount of funding, or maybe you don't have funding as a small business, then how are you gonna get started? So that's why Laura and my take, at least for us, is we would rather have the other companies that have the funding and are able to do that yeah. make the shade ranges, unless you are something like an Orsay where you're like, I'm going to focus on this demographic and I'm going to do that really well.
Right.
And that's worked really well for her. And so for us within skincare, you know, we don't have this challenge because obviously we're not making color products, but I think it's more nuanced than what we see online.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think that these brands are trying to be malicious, when maybe they don't realize the funding that's required to make some of these products. I'm not saying that making a product that's clearly not for someone's skin tone is right. I'm yes. just saying that there's usually more gray areas than what we're seeing.
I had a conversation with another beauty founder, and that was something that she noted as well, and that one of the kind of, it's not a misconception, but something that people are not aware of is just how much it costs
yeah.
to produce, and obviously that should be a big consideration. Like, do you have the budget to be able to yeah. be inclusive, but or focus on a very specific part within the community? But it is a significant investment in, like, you know, the minimum orders, even like yeah. shelf space and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff. There's so much that goes into
and
that.
Like with shade ranges, I mean, again, I'm not a color expert by any means, but from what I've seen online, if you are going to make a range from like this color to this color, then yeah, try to have representation within the full range. I've seen some brands get in trouble where they say they have a full range, but they have like one color on one end, and then most of them are on the other end of the
right.
spectrum. So yeah, I can definitely see why that's frustrating, because then that means that you still made 10 SKUs or 20 SKUs, but you just didn't kind of proportion them right. But yeah, it is really challenging, because again, as a small business, I can understand some of the financial implications of making a fully representative range, which is why we're not in there yet. I think if we were yeah. to launch color, maybe it'd start with like a lip product.
Yeah. Sure. Like dip your toe in ways yeah. that are realistic.
And like talk to your customers, like yeah. understand what they want, is what I would say to the color brands that are getting in hot water right now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there have been a few that have been very...
under the microscope.
And on social media where... Like, there's this one that I saw the other day where, like, they were getting ripped apart because their shade was, like,
I know
this.
Which one you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. We both know.
That was
painful to watch.
Oh, my goodness. And the backlash from that was awful. But again, like, I think in that instance, if we're thinking of the same brand, I think that one was kind of, that was not the right decision by that
I
brand
agree,
just because it was clear they didn't think about adding the ingredients in there to make it not have a gray cast. Yeah. And that's just like negligence, I think, in a way, because you're not doing the research. And then don't say you have a full shade range and launch that SKU if you know it's not going to work for anyone. Mm. So that was tricky, and I do feel bad for that founder, and I don't know what went into that decision, and I hope that they've learned from it.
Yeah, definitely. Growing up, did you see yourself, like, what kind of media did you consume and products? Like, did you consume mostly, like, Western media and Western products, or did you also consume like Asian media and Asian products? So what I'm getting to is, like, did you feel like you saw yourself in the things that you were buying and like the media that you were consuming?
I mean, I was born in Toronto, so I do identify as Canadian, but when I would look at all the magazines and all that as a kid, but I didn't really see anyone that looked like me. So I think in retrospect, I didn't fit into the beauty standards of what I was seeing, although I felt like I did. I don't know if that makes sense, but
100%.
I like resonate more with being Canadian. And I think, and I've heard that people go through this when they are like Chinese and they're born in, let's just say, like the US or Canada. You grow up and you really resist your like parents' identity and like your background. Like, I did not want to be Chinese when I was younger. I think it was because a lot of my classmates were white. And I remember like they would make fun of the things I ate, like such a classic example, like the Tupperware of like homemade food. Now I'm like, wow, my mom really went through effort to make like fried rice. But all I wanted was, what are those? Like Lunchables.
Yeah, Lunchables. I was just thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah, and so like I want to push away my Chinese identity. And then I think it was in high school where I was like, wait, I actually want to learn a lot more about where I was born and like my grandparents and all that. I think, you know, as your grandparents start to pass away, you start to think about your origin story and like you want to know your lineage and all that. So I almost like went the other way where I start to like learn way more about Asian beauty products, start to follow like Asian pop groups and all of that, watch Chinese dramas, Korean dramas. Like I went fully like 180. And I remember in grade 11, I went on a trip with my parents to Taiwan, Macau, where my mom was born, went to Hong Kong, Beijing. And so that was where I was really influenced by Asian beauty, like the skin brightening product and whitening products, the sheet masks. There, like they really emphasize more neutral colors for eyeshadows and lipsticks and things like that. So I brought all that back with me to Toronto. And I think it was in like university that I start to understand how these two worlds mesh together. But to answer your question, I don't think I really identified with one or the other entirely. And I think I've kind of made my peace with that.
Yeah.
But now there's more brands that are more inclusive. So yeah, it's come a long way.
What do you think that as an industry can be done to foster a more inclusive space beyond just marketing and packaging and ad campaigns, like, and go a bit deeper into really making the communities feel like they are being considered and respected and seen in the products that they are consuming?
Yeah. I mean, to help consumers feel seen, I think it's really great to have these community groups. I feel like the best brands that do this are the ones that have some sort of like Slack community or like a Instagram like private community or Facebook groups. Those are really popular. And that's where the brand founders or at least the CEO will communicate more regularly with their consumers and ask questions like, what are you looking for? The shade range, for example, I'm sure those conversations are happening in those groups and listening and actually taking the feedback. I think a lot of brands will ask, but they don't actually listen. At Three Ships, we actually do ask our consumers, you know, if you do want a retinol serum, what other benefits do you want to give you? Do you want to be like brightening as well, or mostly just like the firming and smoothing? What price point do you want? What like, you know, packaging do you want for it? Do you want to be a pump or like a dropper? And we'll actually take this feedback and we'll iterate and include that in the formula and like the way that the packaging is. And then we send out a group, I think it's 50 products now, but we're trying to get to 100. We call it pre-production sample testers, PPS. We should really rebrand that. So the PPS group, they get little like test tube size like packages of future launches before they even launch. And then they try it for 2 weeks and they fill out a survey and they tell us what they think. We make sure that there's people from all different ages, genders, ethnicities, and they're giving us our feedback. And if we see any consistent negative feedback, we actually iterate the formula. So like that's an example of actually listening to your customers and ensuring that there is diversity in that. And I think another way of having more representation in beauty is actually just having more founders that are diverse. Growing up, I didn't see many Asian founders. And like when I went to business school, all the case studies that we studied were like old white men. And I mean, like, yeah, they've done a lot, but I want to see people that look like me, or at least were women in business. And I think obviously that's changed since I graduated in 2015. But I think if you see people like that look like you, you can see that future for yourself. Mm-hmm. And then when you see that future for yourself, you believe you can do it, you do it. And then your own personal experiences as, let's just say, an Asian child growing up Canadian, those will influence the products you make. And that's how you inform bigger change, other than just like marketing.
Yeah.
So we need more representation of people that look like you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. A lot of the you know, past dialogue around beauty was around aspiration, right? Aspirational beauty. How can we get from point A to point B, et cetera? What do you think, or how do you think brands can shift the conversation, you know, away from aspiration and make it more about empowerment and self-expression and being content and happy at where you are versus where you need to be?
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to even just the verbiage you use. Like, a lot of people say anti-aging, for example. And this is something, we had a campaign last year that was anti-anti-aging. And that was our whole tagline. Because if you think about it, the opposite of aging is you die. And would you rather be dead or would you rather be alive? Like, and people don't think about even that term. Like, how often do you hear the term anti-aging?
Yeah.
And that is so related to aspirational beauty, because you're like, okay, well, I want to look 20 forever, and that's just not possible when you're like 80, and I want to live a long life, and we believe in healthy aging. And I think that's where the industry is starting to shift towards, with brands like Three Ships and other brands that are starting to, you know, enforce this dialogue. But I think a lot of it comes down to the subconscious thoughts we have based off of the words that are so prevalent in the industry. And I'm picking on anti-aging because I think it's such a common one.
So
around aspirational beauty, we need to remind people that healthy aging is so important. And I think someone that's done a really great job of this is my co-founder, Laura. You might remember that she was diagnosed with a brain tumor when she was 26. And through her experience of the diagnosis, going through the 10-hour operation and surviving the whole like procedure, and now being at her 5-year mark since the diagnosis, she really reminds me and everyone in her life how much of an honor it is to be able to live and get your wrinkles. And,
and
if you get fine lines and if you get laugh lines, it means you're having fun. Like, if you actually, I was talking to my sister about this over the weekend, and she was like, oh, you know, all of her friends are getting Botox and all that stuff. And I have nothing against those procedures, but I'm like, I like that when I smile, like I can see the lines because it means I've had such a fun life. And yes, some of those lines are from stress, but like, I think a lot of them are from having a very fulfilling life. And I think when you remind people that there's so much more to life than how you look, I think that's where the changes happen. So we just need to look inwards a little more and remind ourselves of what is important to us. And like, when you think about your friends or your family, you're not judging them based off of how they look. Like, you have your circle based off of who makes you feel empowered, who treats you well, like whose values align with yours. You're not judging them based off of, oh, they have 11 lines, like, and like, so I'm not their friend. So I think we have to treat ourselves the way that we treat our friends and family.
It is so true that when I'm thinking about, like, you know, my peer group and stuff, like, some of those lines are things that I actually like about them. And like, those are the features that I actually, that I find are the things that distinguish them and remind me of them. And I find them, you know, endearing and part of them. And it is, you know, to your other point, so true that aging is a privilege that I think a lot of people do not think about enough. No. I think the kind of time we're at in our lives, in as people that are 30 and older, you have to, you start to reconcile with that with, you know, family members that get sick, or friends, or things that happen where you have to kind of confront the fact that like, life is short and things happen, and like, aging is a privilege. And
that we're not invincible.
That is a really good reset in perspective, I think.
Yeah.
as a founder, so 2017, I'm like the such a opposite stereotype. My as an Asian, I'm so bad at math. But you started
years,
in 2017,
7 years.
What would you say in hindsight is your best advice you would give to other women that want to, especially women of color, who want to break into the beauty industry and also just start their own businesses in general?
I think for women in general, and it can apply for Asian women, mm-hmm. is learning to sell. I think sales has such a bad rep, maybe less now, but especially when I was growing up and when I was in university. There was like one sales course in my commerce degree at Queen's, and I took it and it was great, but it was all men in the class. And I think that there's a stereotype that salespeople are like sleazy car salesmen, but that cannot be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. And both Laura and I have sales backgrounds, and we both say that that has been one of the reasons we've been able to grow so fast. And if you think about it as a, like an emerging founder or someone who's young trying to think of starting a company, you're always selling. Like you're selling your product or service, obviously, to your customers. Once you're further along your career, you're selling your vision maybe to potential investors if you want to fundraise. You're selling your mission to future hires, the ones that you really want to bring on. And on hard days, you're even selling the idea of why you started the company to yourself. You're like, why did I do this again? Okay, yes, like XYZ. So learning to sell, I think, is so critical. And I think women tend to shy away from it more than men. But I think women are the best salespeople because we know how to listen well. And sales is less about talking and more about listening, going back to what we said at the start of this interview. So yeah, learn to sell. There's a lot of great books out there about sales and negotiation. The one I always recommend is Never Split the Difference.
I listened to that one. Or I listened to that on audiobook.
Chris Voss.
Yes.
Yeah, so
former FBI negotiator, right? Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So would recommend listening to that.
And at the end of the day, I mean, I guess, yeah, sales is kind of like an icky word for a lot of people, but at the end of the day, it's really more about like advocating for yourself, your business, your team, your vision, like, and standing up for yourself.
Yeah, and helping, like, your customer doesn't know that what you have could actually benefit them too. It's like a win-win. Mm-hmm. If you don't advocate for yourself, they might settle for something that's not as good as what you have to offer, right? So thinking about it from a bigger picture and knowing that you're benefiting them as much as they're benefiting you might help with that negative feeling around being a salesperson.
Yeah, yeah. How would you say your goals, your goalposts have changed from day one where you're like, okay, I want to get, you know, build this out of my, like move from graduate from the kitchen to like a lab or whatever it might've been. How is that different today? Like, what are your goals today as a brand?
So when Laura and I first started, we thought we would sell by the time we were 30 for $10 million, which did not happen as I'm 31. but also we realized along the way that 10 million was such a small goal because within the beauty industry, sales don't usually happen until now when you're 50 million in sales and the multiples are between 3 on the low end to 10 on the high end. I would say usually between 3 to 5x top line. So it's going to be a few years, but that's how the goalpost has moved. I think in the beginning, we also thought of a lot around this 30-year timeline because we thought, okay, want to sell before we have kids. Like, that was the whole thing. We're like, we don't want to be working moms. Like, we want to be done. Like, sell to a really great CPG, like a Unilever, Estee Lauder, have a long-term home for our company, and then move on with our lives because it's too hard to be a working mom.
And have a hobby farm.
Yes. Still on the list. My husband and I are working on that.
Yeah.
But as we've grown and I'm older now, I'm realizing, you know, being a working mom is also, it's a challenge, but it's also really exciting to me. And I think going back to your earlier question around like, how do we get more female founders in this space? Maybe if Laura and I show people that you can have families and you can also be a founder, even if that means slower growth, you can do it. Like, maybe we might inspire people. So that goalpost has also shifted. So the two goalposts like are selling at 30 for 10 million, it's not happening. And also the goalpost around like family planning and trying to keep being a founder and being a mom mutually exclusive, I think there very much is a space for them both.
Yeah, I love that. Last question. What excites you the most about the future of beauty?
Ooh. I mean, something that we've been talking a lot about as a company is AI in beauty. So that's just something that's interesting to me. But around the future of beauty, I mean, I know we've been talking about inclusivity a lot, but I really think we're starting to see brands talking about that more and having that as part of the product development process versus even like 3 to 5 years ago, it was an afterthought. I think inclusivity was more once you were done with the product, you kind of have thought through your marketing budget and then you're like, okay, and then what's the Asian model we can include in this one photo shoot? And that's really starting to change, which is very exciting to me as a Chinese Canadian. So I would definitely say the inclusivity. And I think the fact that the barriers to entry are lower within beauty now. I think back then you had to be like a Unilever or a P&G to have a beauty brand really stand out. But now what you're seeing with these indie brands like Three Ships that are starting to get acquired by these large CPGs, these CPGs are acquiring these indie brands because they're realizing these brands, these indies, have something that they don't have. They built the trust with the consumer that a P&G can't necessarily do. So that's really exciting to me that there's all these brands that have this platform. It's so easy to make a company now, Shopify and like TikTok and Instagram and whatever other new platforms are out there that, you know, Gen Alphas are using. So I think that's really exciting to me that it's a lot more democratized now. So yeah, the inclusivity, the democratization of beauty and AI, I think is going to be really interesting in the next few years. We're going to see so much change. That's exciting.
Amazing. Well, what a great way to end off. Thanks so much for the chat, Connie.
Thanks so much for having me.
I had such a great chat. That was great.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?